I'm Mark Schwain. I've met most of you already, I think, at orientation, and I'm the village philosopher. One of my principal responsibilities is to sort of host and moderate the evening forums, and this is the first forum this week. I'm from Chicago, where I teach. Chicago may ring a bell in some of your minds if you were at the session at 10:30 today. You'll remember that Larry Rasmussen, in order to find a text that exemplified what I think was called male giantism, a kind of spirit of work and triumph and energy and strength and so on, read from Sandburg's poem about Chicago, where words like broad-shouldered, hog butcher, and all of those figured in. Well, now that you look at me, you see that not everybody in Chicago exemplifies that kind of physique. People have called me lots of names, but never macho man. I might also add that we now have a woman who is the mayor of the city, a woman who happens to be the president of my university, where I teach. And when I finish living in the city and teaching at the university, I go home to my wife and daughter, which constitute the rest of my family. So I have a very different view of Chicago from the one that Sandberg gave you. Tonight we're privileged to have with us, I think, Mr. John Dellenbach, a man of considerable experience and accomplishment in a wide variety of areas, some of which I'll mention in a moment. There are two ways to look at this. His wife, I guess, noting his varied career, often jokes that he's a person who can't hold a single job. As a matter of fact, however, he has a degree in economics, and after that a law degree. And then after serving some 4 years in the Navy, he went on to teach business law for some 15 years at Oregon State University. Boy, that was a real mistake. Oregon State University. And the last 6 years of those 15, he was in the state legislature in Oregon. Quite an achievement, I think, to be in the state legislature and be teaching at the same time. It was said of some other prominent Republican politician that he couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time. And that's certainly not true of our guest this evening. After... He can talk and eat an ice cream cone at the same time. Then after serving the state legislature in Oregon, he served for some 8 years from 1967 to 1975. In the United States Congress, and then was for 2 years director of the Peace Corps, and now heads the Coalition of Christian Colleges. He insists he's an Oregonian and from Oregon. That's where he thinks of himself as being from, but he's been, I don't know if he'd put it this way, but in keeping with a lot of the earlier sessions, in exile, I suppose, in Washington, D.C. for the last 14 years. And we thought we'd explore tonight the political issues that this country faces as it looks toward another 4 year, every 4 years we have a kind of national carnival known as a presidential election. And given that that's what we're all facing and looking toward the 80s, we thought we'd explore those issues. Before asking him sort of the first question, I want to say that forums are mainly designed for your input, your questions, your argument, your discussion, so that we can explore these matters together. You're not to hear long presentations. I'm a little wary since I'm an academic and he's a politician, which may be the two most long-winded occupations in the world, that we may not do as good a job as we should of policing one another and cutting one another off. So I'm going to depend on you to do the following thing. As soon as one of the two of us, or anybody else for that matter, seems to be going on too long, just raise your hand, and that means that they have 30 seconds to wind up what it is they're saying. And in my 30 seconds, I'll ask John this question. I think I can do it in 30 seconds.
They're listening, Mark. They heard us.
My question is this. What do you think the major issues are that we face politically as a nation in 1980?
Well, this gets highly subjective, but it would seem to me that the critical issues that the country faces are not necessarily the issues that are going to be involved, at least directly, Mark, if I read it correctly, in the debates that are going to take place from here on out. We're going to have some typical presidential candidate debates, maybe two-party, maybe three-person debates. And they're going to go with the same kind of a pattern that's been followed since John Kennedy and Richard Nixon, I would think. But it seems to me that the real issues that the country is going to face are the acoustics sufficiently good? Can you hear back there?
Yeah.
If you get to the point ever that you can't hear and you still want to hear, would you let us know?
Can you raise your hand?
I won't do that. You see, I think we as a nation are on the verge of being really at a critical time. And I think that, as I would see, we face a couple of critically important international issues, and then a couple of important domestic issues. Among the critically important international issues is how we're going to go about controlling international armaments. Now, they may debate the SALT II Treaty. They may debate the Panama Canal. They may go off into issues of superiority, and we're going to get semantic games about what does it mean to be superior in weaponry, or what do the platform planks say about this, or what do the two candidates or the principal party say, or what you will. But I am deeply concerned that issue is absolutely critical for this country. And we are not coming to grips with it. We're not really coming to grips with, at a time we're talking about increasing defense spending up to $150 billion or so, it's piling armaments on armaments, and the question of what this nation is really going to do about that, I think, is an absolutely imperative, critical issue for our own survival. We could go on whatever length you wanted about that particular one, or what we want to do, and what we're going to do. There's another international one that, to me, is absolutely critical for this nation to face, and that is the question of how we're going to go about dealing with the increasing gap between the haves and the have-nots. Because the gap isn't getting narrowed down. And you all know the statistics. I think predicament of prosperous deals in some of it, so do also Sider's work and some other works in this regard, talking about what it is that the United States, as certainly one of the havest of the have nations, whether it is per capita the havest nation, if there were such a grammatical construction, or just one of them. The point is, we're way up the line. And if you deal with what it is we're doing to try to help the have-not nations, on a percentage of what we have the capacity to do, we are doing a constantly increasingly small amount. I'm not confusing again the grammar of the situation. We're not leading the nations of the world in the percentage of the gross national product that we're contributing to help the nations. We're way down the pipe, whether we're 13 or 14 or 15 by now, or wherever else it is. On a percentage of what we have the capacity to do, we're quite far down the line. And I think that is a critically important issue that this nation is really not coming to grips with. I think from the standpoint of the domestic, I jotted down a couple of issues that I think are among them. how do we prepare in this country to deal with a declining national standard of living? See, the talk is the pie gets bigger and bigger. How do we go about helping? We help not by those who have it, I'm thinking in terms of this country, not by those who have the most, giving up to help those who have the least. We talk about somehow increasing the pie so that those who have not can also get a cut of the pie, while those who have can continue to get increasing amounts of the pie. I think, from a subjective standpoint, we've got to come to grips with the fact that that is not going to continue. And when it is not going to continue, when the pie is not going to get larger and larger, beyond a certain point, and in certain areas we'll be able to continue to do certain things, then what do you do about a change in the distribution? And the other one, how do we foster somehow in this country a concept of service? I was going to say national service. That sounds like the draft and aspects of the draft, and maybe that's one of the mechanics we use to use to do a deal with it. But I don't hear debate on that particular concept. You don't hear the Kennedy ask not what you can do, but ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. Or any other aspect of that kind of getting away from the me generation and going to the serve generation. And I would say, Mark, without going any further into it, that these are among the really critical issues for this nation to face. Whether or not they appear in any form in the presidential debates, I'm not very confident. I'm not very confident that they will. But that's the kind of thing which really this nation has got to be facing in the time that lies immediately ahead, and a bunch of other things.
Okay. Responses to that? Questions? Additional issues? I'd like to just ask them myself. There's been a kind of undertone in what you said at the beginning and then just now of what I take to be some skepticism or worry or doubt whether or not our own political process, the one that will issue in the actual election, addresses these, as though either inadvertently or due to some fault in the system, that the central issues, such as the ones you mentioned, simply get ignored or sidestepped or watered down and so on. And so I'm asking, as someone who's actually serving the Congress, are you skeptical about our own political process as a mechanism for facing up to these things?
I am less skeptical about the system having the capacity to face up to it than I am, although there's some very real questions whether we are not like Rome getting close to the bread and circus time when the people are going to be demanding those things and those who have them will give them to them. When you get to the situation as you do in our elective process, that the people who are in the position to give the bread and circuses depend upon the people putting them in office and upon their then getting the dollars from the people to turn around to do something about it, I think it gets to be hazardous. But I still think that in the Churchillian sense, it's the best system going that I know of in the world at the present time. But I'm not sure that our people are ready to face this particular kind of thing. I think, to say it right in simple form, if it were not for my deeply held Christian faith, I would be a terrible pessimist, nationally and internationally, at this time. And the kind of question that I put out a few moments ago that we've got to be facing, if you really look at the questions, at least three of the four, and maybe all four of them, really depend upon a change in the spirit of people. And unless we are ready to do something really dramatic about that kind of thinking ourselves. And let me be cynical and provocative. And I'm not convinced that even the Christian churches in this country are ready to face up to it. And if the Christian churches are not ready to face up to it, then I don't know who is willing to face up to it, about what we're willing to give up for our own people, to say nothing of the people of the rest of the world. And shy that kind of a change in attitude, I think we're in for some terribly difficult times where the crisis may have to come first, and then the dealing with it, instead of what ought to happen, where we're dealing with it before the crisis gets.
Where do you see foreign policy being established? At what location? Is it in the Congress? Is it in the office of the President? Or is it in the State Department? Or where?
Foreign policy is basically the one area of responsibility where the President has a lot of flexibility that he can run pretty much on his own, to a significant degree on his own, without the Congress. And the only thing that the Congress can deal with it is the few pieces that are put together. The ratification of treaties by the Senate, but the President can deal with those as he's dealing with SALT II, where they're not even taking up the ratification of SALT II in the Senate, and yet having negotiated the treaty, the President's in a position by executive order to do everything almost that we're called upon to do under SALT II. So that's an example of how the President has the authority to deal even where the Senate must ratify and consent. Must advise and consent. You also have the President reaching out to nations like the People's Republic of China without the Congress having been consulted in connection. But of course the Congress enters. The Congress enters essentially because it must deal in terms of the dollars and the Senate's advice and consent. But in the foreign affairs field, the President has a great deal of flexibility and authority to move on.
And then we're faced with the possibility of a change every 4 years, which gives us no foreign policy that has any length to it or breadth to go on.
4 years is a considerable period of time within which to do some things. 8 years is, of course, even longer as a policy time within which to do some things. I must confess, again, I'll keep laying them on the line, I must confess that I do not see, and it goes back more than the last 3.5 years, real consistency in the presidencies. Not only between them, but within them, within the periods that a given person serves in that particular office.
John, earlier this afternoon you said in terms of electing persons to political office, knowing the person, not judging a given voting record or measuring it up to certain standards, is the best way to do that. Assuming for the moment that Anderson makes it on the docket, within the three candidates, whom would you see as perhaps addressing the issues that you have brought forth in as Christian a way as you see they can be addressed?
I am a Republican. I have been a Republican, and whatever my wife does, I will stay a Republican. Because I think we need to have both of the major parties possessed of a wide range of thinking. I really, among us, am terribly troubled about all three candidates. Not one candidate, not two candidates, but all three candidates. And you can start into an analysis of why you're troubled about all three of the candidates. But frankly, I think that you can chew at any one of the three. Now, well, since we're forumizing and not having to present a logical thesis that moves from alpha to omega and just lays it all out for you, let me say, I think the presidency has gotten to be the kind of a job, and there's nothing new in this, but it is absolutely true, that is almost impossible to handle. We may have found ourselves having moved into a situation, I'm not using this as a prediction of what's going to happen in 3 months, but we may have a series of one-term presidencies for an indefinite period of time. Because the job, coupled with the job, is so complex, and the situation into which the world is moving is so terribly complex, that it may be that it will be impossible for any one man or woman to get into that position and come through a 4 years and still be immensely popular. I mean, that's an appalling statistic that's published recently about Carter's present popularity. That can go up and like, down like a yo-yo. You give some international crisis in the next 3 months, and the American public is perfectly capable of turning around and going the other way, so far as Mr. Carter is concerned. So I don't think that betokens the end of the road at all for him. I'm saying what it should or should not do, because I confess that I find difficulty with all three of them. I think, quite frankly, there are... that may be enough.
Stop this short there.
I would guess that everyone in this room and most of the people in the world feel that the armaments race is yet completely out of hand, that we are investing far too much of the world's resources in wild and irrational attempts to outgun each other. I think the thing that is so perplexing for most people is, why can't the arms race be stopped? Why can't heads of state come to a rational meeting of the minds? And why can't we put the resources of the world in the area that we want to do?
Afghanistan. I don't mean to be... don't we have a program for tomorrow night that deals with this particular thing?
Wednesday
night that deals with the matter of armaments?
Yeah.
And so maybe we shouldn't try to jump the gun on that particular one as who's going to be leading that particular discussion. But, yeah, I mean, I think you've got a couple of too simplistic answers that I throw out at least as grist for what's going to happen. I think that we're into an habitual way of thinking so far as the world is concerned, that's the way you secure security. I think you're into a situation where there is an appalling lack of trust as to what the other person is going to do under a set of circumstances where there's also what Eisenhower warned us against. And by the time you get into spending the absolutely unthinkable amounts of money that were involved in this, there's so many vested interests. And I do not mean to be cynical. I think that one of the really exceptionally fine men in the business world today is Tom Phillips of Raytheon. Chairman of the board of Raytheon. An exceptionally fine man. I think his sincerity as a Christian and his feelings as a man, he's really first rate if anybody's had the privilege of knowing. And yet Raytheon is one of the giant dealers in this field. Now what does that say? I don't know what it says, you see. Except that there is such an intertwining of even first-rate people with the whole system as it's functioning, that I think that a lot of inertia is involved in this. And all of those elements are part of the elements of the inertia.
Okay, the question is here.
It's fine and noble to talk about limiting munitions in the arms race, and it's also fine and noble to talk about the haves giving to the have-nots, and I'm not trying to be facetious, but I really can't help but wonder, is that any longer the United States of America's role to go around being either the policeman of the world or the sort of paternalistic godfather that's going to right all the wrongs and straighten everything out? Maybe this country's got a lot of problems within its own borders, and inevitably, what is foreign aid? It's handing out charity to countries in the world. And people that accept charity, they'll accept it, but 1 year, 2 years, 10 years down the line, they end up hating whoever gave them the charity. They end up biting the hand that feeds them. I mean, look at Iran, for example. I mean, God knows how many arms, how many billions of dollars worth of arms and munitions that was given to that country.
Or so.
Yeah. And what happened. I mean, when Britain was the most powerful country in the world, she was also the most hated country in the world. Maybe it's time to concentrate more on domestic problems. There's lots of them, and let the world look after itself. It's got to learn how to do it sometime, sooner or later, on its own. I mean, why should the United States be doing it all the time for them? And often getting into situations that, you know, really hurt the country.
Anybody want to comment on that?
Could I add just to what you said? I found it very interesting what you just said, because there is, I'm European myself, and I'm
Canadian.
And I find there is a growing tendency, as far as we can judge from that part of the world, in the United States towards let the rest of the world take care of themselves. We have got to see to our own. How do you judge the situation within the Congress and your colleagues? On this particular matter, on more of a tendency towards isolationism instead of going more into the issues, more deeper into the... Because there is, of course, this mistrust of the American leadership that is very strong in Europe.
I've made the comment about the national government that what we have is 435 dukes and 100 counts, very few of whom acknowledge a king. That's sort of the situation that they're going off in all directions. What happened? May I say just a word about congressional reform at this stage of the game? People were talking a few years ago. I'm a great believer, and I'll get back to that, to congressional reform in just a second, but I'm a great believer in the tidal system of dealing with national problems. I think that if you look back over relatively recent history, at least, you find great tides come sweeping in. And the tide of high public interest and congressional interest in civil rights sweeps in and does certain things and enacts legislation, and then the tide ebbs and certain things have been accomplished and many things are left undone. And civil rights has swept in, and the war on poverty has swept in, and a series of such great movements take place. Anytime the tide is sweeping in one of these moves or ebbing, there are also cross currents that take place that are independent of the tide, but things are happening. All right, now, in congressional reform, one of the things that was talked of some few years ago, and it was a great front and center issue, was congressional reform. But an aspect of it that really escaped much public attention, at least as I saw it in editorials or in informed comments that were made about congressional reform, is that two very different ideas came under the blanket of congressional reform. When people talked about the need for reform, when the executive department of the federal government had gotten to be so strong, some of them were saying, what you need is a way to reform the Congress so that it has the capacity to not just lie there supplying while the executive rolls over it. You need a strong Congress that can move and do certain things and set off in balance against the executive branch. That was one kind of congressional reform of which people spoke. Another kind of congressional reform was, look, what you have in the Congress is a situation where the seniority system is so powerful, all of the entrenched old guard run the show. And what you need and what you've got is smoke-filled rooms and closed committee rooms, and the average member of the Congress, the backbencher in the British system, doesn't really get to speak out and do very much under these circumstances. So what we've got to do is to reform the Congress to change that system. It's an entirely different kind of congressional reform. And so two kinds of reform battle with each other, one of which would make, if you will, the Congress more alert and responsive and able to move and do something like this, but the very thing that would make that possible, strong speakers, strong presiding officer in the Senate, strong committee chairman, so that they could sit down with a dozen people saying, what should we do, think, 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 this is what we'll do, and go out and do it.
as happened when Lyndon Johnson was the Senate Majority Leader, as happened when Sam Rayburn was the Speaker of the House. Those men ran the show, Joe Cannon, along with others back before them. They ran their Congress. That's one kind of reform. But the other kind of reform was to be sure that things didn't happen in secret, to water down the seniority system, that make sure that the minority had powers that it didn't have before. That's another kind of reform. But what that did was to lessen the capacity of the Congress to move like this and to yield results that could be relied upon and that a handful of people could bring about. Now, I happen myself, in the struggle between those kinds of reform, to come down principally in the second camp, saying that's really what we need for good legislation. You need really open proceedings, and you need not deals being made. You need an open, full debate kind of operation. But that makes for inefficiency. And the net result is that was more the kind of reform that the Congress has come out with, and the net result is the Congress has been less able to really produce, to be relied upon results that a handful of people could say we will do. Tip O'Neill, for all his authority as Speaker of the House, is not in a position to produce on the close issue. He can produce on some issues. He can get the Congress. He can get his people to go with him. But with the overwhelming majority that the Democrats have in the present House, they have not been able to mount a consistent legislative policy. And I don't mean to get off into the political debate. I'm talking numbers, and I'm talking the system would probably be the same under the present set of rules if the Republicans had that same kind of majority control of the House. Because the reform has changed the system. And we're into a system where, into a situation where I do not think we can count on strong leadership coming under the present circumstances of a policy nature, particularly of a nature that reaches forward and deals with problems before they arise, that deals in a preparatory, preventive sense for problems. The Congress still has the capacity to act quickly, but it deals quickly in retrospect in dealing after the time instead of in preparation for the time.
Yes, that's right.
I'd like to speak to the two non-U.S. citizens about isolation and whether or not we continue to help. And all of that's coming back to one of the first things you said, John, the haves and the have-nots. We had a film on Sunday, and Dom Elder Camara from Brazil said that the final struggle, or the struggle in the world, is not primarily between East and West, but between North and South. And then he went on to explain that, and I think that is correct. What I find is even more controversial than whether or not we're going to continue to help the have-nots is the political issue of whether or not in the process of us being in those countries, we have not, in fact, benefited from them. Not only is our foreign aid, I think it's 14th out of 18 giving nations. It's either 13, 14, or 15. But we do not listen, and I'm not an expert on it, but I have heard people from those countries say things like, "We're not asking for your charity. We're asking that you stop robbing us." That's a little different sense to our isolation. You certainly, if Helmut Frenz was here from Chile, would say Chile was trying, and your CIA and your multinational, whatever it took to overthrow that, was certainly not the kind of foreign aid we needed. I mean, those are the real controversial voices that I don't think any politician can afford to speak to in this present election. At least I don't hear them. That really is controversial to say, is it true that our being in those countries has been primarily for our benefit? Dom Elder Camara's statement was there is a natural link between the wealthy countries of the world, the first world nations, being in our countries and wanting them to have, he called them, right-wing dictatorships. Two reasons: financial stability and no dissent. That makes for better investment. At least that voice, it seems to me, should be heard within our discussions in the United States, but I don't hear it very often. We hear it at Holden, but we don't hear it politically. And I'd be glad if you'd speak to it, but I think we really have to face that one too.
Say significantly amen to what you said. I tell you, I'm even more troubled that I don't find within the churches with which I'm most directly familiar a great deal of cry in this direction.
Yeah.
We've got a, in the Washington scene, you have a number of strong churches of the major denomination. But I hear a paucity of crying out along these particular lines. I didn't say, incidentally, we should continue. You said your question was a good, provocative one. And let's hear any reactions that come from the group to it. But what I raised as a question was, how we're going to deal with it. You see, I think the question is not, can we continue foreign aid? Can AID and these public laws that deal with the distribution of grain abroad and the like continue? Or even, if you will forgive my subjectivity, the most effective international relationship agency that we have in the United States, the Peace Corps, that even that is to go on and to do the job by itself. Any of those particular ones. But I say, that's one of our problems. This nation must deal with that. Yeah. And so far we have.
Well, I think something like the Peace Corps that is relatively low-key, sort of labor-intensive, expertise-intensive, getting down to the grassroots, that's the kind of thing you should be doing. But just like this gentleman over here was saying, the average foreign aid seems to fall in the wrong hands all the time. It does fall in the wrong hands. The people in the country that where this has happened, they know it. They end up hating you for it, and you have to look no further than, say, the voting record of the Third World in the United Nations to see it visibly demonstrated. I mean, you think back to your own town or wherever you come from. You want to help people out, and it's a Christian thing to do. It's a very basic human thing to do, and by all means, you should help people out. But there comes a time when human individuals have to learn how to help themselves, and I think it's also true with countries. They have to learn how to pick themselves up by the bootstraps and do it. I mean, I can't help but thinking of Israel a lot. You know, I mean, that country, like, you know, throw all the other considerations aside. I mean, it's sitting there in the middle of the desert, and sure, it had a lot of money behind it and all that, but by God, it's picked itself up and really done it. Yet,
not by itself.
Well, no, with some help, all of this, but you can't underestimate what they've done over there.
To debate the issue, where I think I would come to immediate grips with you, is on the question of doing it by themselves. Surely there's a whale of a difference between the feeding the fish and teaching the fish. And we do too much feeding the fish.
Yeah, I think the teaching end would be much better. Yeah.
But still, that doesn't say that the person can learn to fish by himself or herself. Somebody who knows how to fish has to deal with it. Too often American aid, if you will, in my opinion, takes the form of our going into the country and saying, okay, now these are your problems. We've made this analysis, and we're going to tell you exactly what you need to do to straighten up. And if you straighten up and fly, do what we tell you to do, you'll be flying right pretty soon. One of the, if you will, strengths of Peace Corps is that it has striven, in recent years at least, the last 10 years, to go into the country and sit down and through complex relationships say, in effect, what are your problems? What do you want us to help you with? Education? Healthcare? Agriculture? These are the three areas in which Peace Corps has done most of its present work. But it's a case of asking the country what it wants and then striving to help them where they see their great areas of need. Not telling them in advance what it is we're going to do for them.
Yes. I want to just raise a question about an assumption. Do you think countries hate us because we help them or because we exploit them?
Well, maybe, it's probably a little bit of both, but it's a sad fact of human nature that if you're on the receiving end, you get a little resentful of it. It's sad, but it's true.
But I guess I'm really questioning the assumption.
I can't hear you very well.
You know, I'm questioning the assumption that countries hate us because we're doing so much to help them. I would lean more towards the fact that, as John mentioned, that economic injustice, multinational corporations. It's more what we're doing to take from those countries that would raise the hatred more than what we're doing to help. I just wonder what you think.
The embarrassing thing is that time after time, if you look with a microscope at what it is that the United States has done, take PL, 438, the Food for Peace situation where we've dealt with it. Great service. We've taken the capacity of the United States to grow food that can feed the world. And we've given a great deal of that away. Think back for a moment, though, friends. What gave rise to that particular program? Gluts. Granaries that were filled
And somebody dreamed up this great program that would take care of all the grain that our farmers didn't know what to do with, that were pouring out of storage warehouses, and we said, hey, we'll give it away. But it didn't grow out, even in its date. Now, of course, there were some wonderfully fine people who helped create that program, and some of them were motivated by the very finest of motives. But by and large, that was an effort on the part of the United States to get rid of something that was getting to be expensive and embarrassing, instead of really saying, how can we best help those who are in desperate need? Ah, this is the way we can help those particular people. And we've got to be ready.
Yeah.
Given the series of issues for the future that you outlined, how should we understand the opposite reaction, the opposite direction that seems to be the one being taken by the Republican Party, especially with concrete reference to the platform plank calling for clear superiority in armaments over the Soviet Union?
You know, in the political world, when you're asked a question that you don't particularly want to deal with, well, there's a couple of ways to deal with it. Now, that's a very good question. And I'm glad you asked that. that's a very perceptive question, and it's the sort of thing that really is, gets complex in its answering, and so you and I can talk about that afterwards.
Right.
Now, are there any other questions? The question deserves better than that. I'll give part of my own particular answer. After serving on the platform committee once, I've been a delegate to three national conventions. Mary Jane was elected, and I was in the Peace Corps. Mary Jane ran for and was elected as a delegate from Oregon to a convention. So together we participated in four national conventions. On one of those, I served as a member of the platform committee. I may say to you that it was an interesting experience for what was then a young politician, because it was back in 1964 when I was in the state legislature. And if you remember, the Republican Party nominated a man named Goldwater at that particular time. The platform was a very conservative platform. That's where I first met Mel Laird. I went to that platform and was one of the minority, if you will, who fought long and hard against a number of the concerns that were in that platform. I had the chance to participate from the floor of the Cow Palace in debate on some of the minority planks, where we were trying to get the majority to go with us on some of the platform planks. And I tell you, it was an interesting thing. I don't think some of you will remember that. And you'll remember that when Nelson Rockefeller rose to speak at that convention, there was a cascade of vitriol and hate that came pouring out of the balcony of the Cow Palace. And I can tell you that I know what it felt like, because I was to speak on the next amendment after Rockefeller, and I severed an Achilles tendon at the time, so I had a big full-length cast on, and so they got me up on the platform before I was ready to debate. I was sitting there when Rockefeller, no further away from me than where you are, was standing right in front, and I was sitting in a chair behind waiting for them to finish that so we could get up and carry our share of the debate on the next minority plank we were going to come forward with. And you could almost feel the feelings that booze, the cascade of things come pouring down out of the balcony on him. And if you will, disagree with Rockefeller on issues, as you may, it's where I generated a great respect for this man. Because when you could almost feel it in the air, this dislike and maybe hate, instead of cowering or instead of looking around apprehensively as to what it was all about, he stood there, he crossed his legs, and he stood there while the boos were coming on him. The chairman of the committee of the House at that time of the convention, Thurston Morton, was banging the gavel and trying to quiet him down. He finally turned to Rockefeller, and I heard him say, "Nelson, go ahead and speak. You're the chairman. You get him quiet, and I'll talk." He just stood there with all that pounding down around him, and I came out of that having said those things. If you give me a personal anecdote about it. Having helped create a platform, I come out with very little feeling about platforms. I don't think they mean Well, you see, that may be a very interesting comment. But you go down the list of the governors, you go down the list
of the senators. You go down the list of the congressmen or the state legislators who are going to run in this election. And the same thing will be true of the platform that's adopted next week, friends. So I'm not talking about one party or the other. I'm just saying, you take them plank by plank and candidate by candidate, and first of all, you won't find 15% who will have read the platform with all its details. And then of the full group that have dealt with it, you'll find them selectively going along with the platform and its planks. I have great trouble, and that's, I suppose, the preamble to it. I have great trouble with a series of planks. But I take refuge in the fact that I don't think those planks are going to prevail. I think in the final analysis, what's going to take place in the Congress of the United States as they debate the issues that are involved in those planks, fortunately, will not be bound by what the platform plank may
be. I'm not so concerned about specific planks as I am about the platform as a whole and the mood that I think it engenders in the country. And it seems to be anti-this, anti-that, bound back to the Stone Age old republicanism that I thought had gone out 25 years ago, at least, or better. And I'm not so worried. I mean, the individual planks are disturbing to me. But I've been active in the Republican Party, and I've seen the John Birchers work up a froth over gun control or some issue. And I worry about those folks in the Republican Party, that part of our country, being kind of whipped into a frenzy over the possibility that Ronald Reagan and this platform are the next 8 years of reality around here, and that they've got free rein for their frenzy. And I mean, see, it's a mood thing as much as more important to me than the individual planks, and it disturbs me to the extent that I'm about to throw my Republican Party ticket out the window and just say, I can't stand on that.
I'm as troubled as you by a series of those particular planks, and I don't mean to debate any of those who are here who would classify themselves as conservative. I would just say in simple, I'm truly troubled that walking with some of those planks, if that become national policy, will be to the best interests of this nation, and I'm deeply troubled that I have great trouble squaring some of them with my Christian concepts. I think it's really troubled. And I buy with you in what you said, I'll quit with this, that the mood that walks with them. And I don't think it's confined to the one partisan. Part of what troubles me is that I think it is, to a degree, a widely held national mood. And that's terribly disturbing.
And it's possible that it's that mood that, and you should appreciate this as an attorney, it's possible that it's that mood which will be appointing maybe up to four of the next Supreme Court justices. I mean, that's the concrete reality of it. I think it's that mood that plays into those kinds of appointments.
I think you had a question earlier.
Yes, I'm not an attorney, nor a politician, nor an academic.
We statesmen look upon politicians as scamps.
And I'd like to make a point of this young fellow's initial statement or question about the military armament and superiority. I think that's what you were addressing. And I didn't quite understand your response to it. But
I didn't speak specifically. I was dealing with a general question rather than that one. However, I don't need to duck it. If I can do, I'll be ready to go on. Go ahead.
Well, I reread today an article that was actually a speech that Alexander Sloshkin, if I pronounce that correctly, had read to the Harvard graduating class in 1978. And I thought that was really something. He said the Americans, or the Western nations, lack courage. And he pointed out, if I understand this correctly, that you can't deal with the Soviets in anything other than strength. And he was really concerned that we didn't have the courage to deal with them under those terms. And I think that, in my own view, we do need to have a strong military. We no doubt have a lot of garbage that goes in with it when we get this big budget. I can see that. But I don't think we can ignore this sort of a problem. It seems to me that we do have to have that strong military.
What did the strength of the Soviets accomplish in Afghanistan? What did the strength of America accomplish in Vietnam? Tell me that. Tell me. I mean, brute strength and bombs and missiles, come on. You know, you got to do better than that. So, I'm not saying you can throw them out the window. You can't. As long as the other side has them, you have to have a reasonable amount yourself. But if you think that somewhere down the road, the answer is having imagined military superiority over those awful Ruskies, that attitude just isn't going to do it. We're going to be condemned to doing these awful things like Vietnam and Afghanistan over and over again.
Yeah. And so long as we depend on the United States to carry the load for us, we can talk like that.
And we don't.
I disagree with you completely.
What? That's, you're certainly free to.
And I don't think the Americans today have the courage to stand up to deal with the problem. I'm a pessimist, just as you said.
You touched on two things that I think time precludes our going into terribly deeply, but let me just make a brief comment on one: the feeling of Americans at the present time and what we're willing or not willing to do. That's a complex one by itself. We're still feeling the aftermath of Vietnam.
Right.
We're not where Eisenhower was when he sent the troops in 11 years ago, and just like that, and all of America was behind what he sought to do. But you see, when you got to talking about the military, Wilson, just a minute ago, you changed the terminology too. You said it's important that we be strong. I don't think you'd find many Americans at the moment who would feel safe denying that. But that's a different set of words than superiority. It's my own conclusion at the present time that it is impossible for the United States to be across the board superior to the Russians, and give it, I don't know what the time period will be, maybe as short as 10 years, maybe longer than that, also the People's Republic of China. They're a sleeping giant indeed, and I think that we've got to be very careful of where that situation is going to go. But it's one thing to remain strong while we try to negotiate out another kind of resolution of the problem, contrasted with trying to get superiority, because, if you will, I'm persuaded that an effort on our part to be superior is just going to be an escalating thing where we can't have it. First, we can't have it across the board. We just don't have the money and the material and the technical capacity to do it across the board. We can get temporary advantages in certain areas. We've had it in submarines. We've had it in certain types of weaponry, wind weaponry, for example, planes, for example, and a series of such things. But the Russians have it in certain other areas. And if that goes on and on and on and on, coupled with the fact that there is an increasing number of nations which also have hydrogen weaponry or nuclear weaponry of one kind or another, I'm just very fearful that at some stage, some madman is going to push a button. And then who knows what it is? Katie, bar the door. I don't think there can be a long-term resolution of the needs on that kind of a basis. We must remain strong while we try to find and move forward aggressively to find another kind of resolution of that. And I think that has to be through negotiation. With all the questions about trust, and they've got them as we have. Terribly complex. We're not going to get there by a constant escalation of the arms race.
We're sure not trying to get there. Mr. Good, go ahead. Let me get
yes, ma'am.
I was just going to say, with all of our arms, it was rather strange today in our power that the government arrested 146 Iranian students who were protesting in Washington, D.C. The students refuse to give their name and are on a hunger strike and go limp when you try to pick them up. And we're the announcer concluded, we really don't know what we're going to do with them. You know, I think that's kind of the same situation we have in Iran, too. With all of our strength, we really are kind of helpless.
With all of those problems, and I suspect that it's driving the Immigration and Naturalization Service up the wall, and I imagine it's driving the City Police of Washington, D.C. up the wall, and I imagine it's driving a whole series of people up the wall. Isn't it great that that can happen in this country? I don't think there are many places in this country, where, in this world, where that kind of thing could happen. Can you imagine what would happen in Iran if the converse took place? Can you imagine what would happen in Russia, even in the People's Republic of China, or any of the other nations of which I know? So for all its frustrations, and I'm with you in the frustrations and the interesting challenge of what do we do about that? What do we do about that situation? What do we do about the Mexican aliens and they're coming across the border and all the problems that go with that, and on and on and on with a series of them? This nation's a strange, wonderful beast.
Yes.
Considering the turmoil within the Democratic Party now on their presidential hopeful, is there any way that the primary system can be improved? Can we do a better job? From my perception, we're doing a lousy job of picking presidents. Maybe they're just lousy candidates. But we sure can't pat ourselves on the back for the last 15 years.
What we're getting with...
Maybe get what you ask for.
What we're getting at the present time in the process. I don't know how many of you read the June issue of Reader's Digest and Peter White's write-up on it. The man who wrote the presidency books back up the line, he's also now written this very interesting article. I would suggest you look at that. It deals with the matter of the primaries, and it says some very interesting and I think largely accurate things about it. And realize that what you're getting in the way of these conventions right now is the result of reform. They're like the Congress. There's reforms back and forth. Reforms make a stronger Congress, wide open, stronger back and forth, it goes back and forth. So also what we're getting in primaries is the result of a reform that came in with one purpose in mind, and out of that purpose has come a result that nobody anticipated when they passed those amendments just a handful of years ago.
Somebody back here wants to see.
It was earlier in connection with something said about Latin America, in the Chile, for instance, being exploited, or aid given to Chile, in a way, was not aid, it was exploitation rather than aid. I'd like to ask you, what do you do in Congress to control or to check the transnational companies and their influence on world economy? Do you do anything, and what possibilities do you have to check there?
First, let me say one thing that most of the group know. I am not now in the Congress, so when you say what do we do, you don't mean what I am doing. I've spent 8 years as a member, but I am not at the present time a member of the Congress. Mm-hmm. So I.
What
those people are doing is just messing everything all up. But let me speak to it. You see, the basic instruments that the United States lawmakers have to deal with the transnationals are sort of indirect tools. They deal through the tax laws. And that has some effect. That's what is being done now, for example, in dealing with the question of payoffs or utilization of funds to bribe or deal on the basis that the national governments of other companies, of other nations do, or what the system is in those countries, however you want to deal, however you want to call it. The point is, the tax laws are one of the great instruments that are used to deal with this. What happens within the country is, in significant degree, the law of that country. And what many of our transnational companies are doing is learning what the laws and the system of operation within other countries may be, and then seeking to mold their structures within those countries to fit that. The United States laws, by and large, you see, don't apply there as to how they do business over there. It is only in connection with the coming back into this land again that we have the leverage or the instrument and the capacity to do anything at all. Our tools are indirect tools in significant degree rather than direct tools. It takes a combination of what the countries themselves abroad wish to do and what it is that our people wish to do, and then holding our people accountable under the tax law, which is the greatest single weapon, just as it was the instrument used to catch Al Capone years ago, reaching into an entirely different field. It was a tax violation that Capone was gotten on, not killing people or running narcotics or something else of the like. So also it is that that's the greatest instrument, to the best of my knowledge, in dealing with transnational.
Yes.
For the use of a better term, and to kind of allude to what this gentleman had spoken to earlier, he talked about negotiations, and I guess semantically we use the term communism for the lack of a better term, maybe the opposite of democracy. But when you talk about negotiations, do you look at negotiating with the communists, and when they say something, to hold that then to be truth? And if you can't look at that as being truth, then what's the next step you take in the negotiations?
You're talking about sanctions as to how you police the
agreement. Well, the SALT treaties, you could start there, I guess.
There's certainly complexities in how you go about verifying, and these have been some of the stickiest factors in SALT negotiations, how you verify whether or not people on either side are dealing accurately with their commitments, dealing faithfully with their commitments and accurately in what they say about what they're doing. And then, in addition to verification as one of the sticky issues, is the question of sanction. Of what if they broke? What if they breach the agreement, whatever the agreement may happen to be? Then what do you do about it? Those are very sticky terms when there is no international law that applies, and when it is the power of might. Both of them are tough. I don't have the answer to the thing except to say it is imperative, if for no other reason, enlightened self-interest. Now, I think there should be and are other reasons, but if for no other reason, enlightened self-interest should take countries of the power and magnitude of the USSR and the USA and the PRC and put them into a situation where they must realize the leadership of the USSR must be aware of the fact that any kind of a real nuclear war between our nations would devastate both countries and run the risk of destroying civilization as we know it. Gee, a few years ago, I had the opportunity, and when I was still on the Hill, I went out on a Polaris sub that was making a trial run. It had been back for repairs, and they were changing from the gold crew to the blue crew, and they were having a shakedown before they went out for business. And just making that one run with that sub, we took off, we went out to sea, we submerged,
We floated around a while in a way that it would be very difficult for anybody to find us. And while down there, they shot out one practice round. Now, it was practice, it was dummy, it was a testing of the torpedo tubes at that particular, not torpedo tubes, but the propellant tube at that time for the missile they were sending off. And it was clear to me that just what I had just seen was absolutely, to me, frightening when you recognize what it could be. Had we been out for business and somewhere else other than a couple of miles off our coast, that one ship had the capacity to send off X number of those particular missiles. And every one of them could have been targeted in on a principal city of our opponent and done almost incalculable damage in that city. And that was one ship of which we have Y number out there. And it is by now true that the USSR has similar ships out in the ocean. And each one has the capacity to lay, well, fortunately, we'd be as safe here as probably anywhere in the country, but to lay the city of Washington or the city of New York or the city of Miami or the city of Chicago or San Francisco or Seattle in ruins. The one vessel has the capacity to do that. And it's sort of like Eisenhower making his comments on atomic weaponry, that the impact of that kind of weaponry is so awesome that we can't really consider using it. Now, those weren't his words, and I'm paraphrasing the concept, but the answer must lie in looking at every conceivable alternative. Because if you play with those things long enough, and if they stay there long enough, and if people continue to make them more sophisticated and build more of them, and try to outdo the other fellow doing it, someday something's going to go wrong. And if that's important, then it's devastation for civilization.
I think I'm going to just take one more question and then let those who want to leave and want to ask more questions, please stay and do that after this question. I want to remind you, Wednesday night represents a forum on disarmament, the arms race, and so on. So a lot of this will be continued then. I hope you'll be with us again on Wednesday. So if we just take one more question now and then leave your question, and then the rest of you can stay if you want to ask still more.
Well, this isn't a question so much as it's a comment. I can't help but think that a lot of our military paranoia is somehow tied into how we treat the rest of the world. And I've heard a couple of comments tonight, sort of two sides of American foreign policy, one being the going back to isolationism, saying let the rest of the world handle itself, and the other being that the food aid paternalistic types of things are important too. And my comment would be that a middle ground where, getting back to this idea of the real tension is not east-west but north-south, we realize that if our profile in the world is lower, if we realize that the countries that we exploit by importing their raw goods and materials and making all sorts of money off of them, we're not doing those people any good, and we're increasing tension by doing it. If we would take the attitude that to help foster world peace and to kind of reduce our own military paranoia, if we could get, for example, countries like Brazil, where they've stopped shipping raw logs now and are starting to build manufacturing plants and pulp plants and these kinds of things, if we could help these countries to become more self-sufficient instead of bouncing from isolationism to paternalism and back, I can't help but think where some of our own military paranoia might be lessened a bit. That's just a comment.
I think that if we do that kind of thing, and I think that we must face that, because either we will do it voluntarily
or it's going to increasingly be done involuntarily to us, it's going to, without any question, have an impact on our own standard of living. Because, you know, the statistics on the raw materials that are imported, of the major, of the, 14 minerals that are imported for manufacturing in that, in our industrial machine, we are already dependent on imports for more than 50% of some 8 of them, I believe, at the present time, and it's estimated that by the year 2000 we would be dependent on imports for more than 50% of everything but, I think, phosphate, something of this statistical nature. The point is, if they close down on those exports from their country, imports into our country, as I think is going to happen to an increasing degree, oil is just the beginning of this thing, it's going to have a fearsomely upsetting impact on our American industrial machinery. See, I think back to the beginning of this, I'm going to make this one last comment before anybody understandably departs. I think it's going to happen. The question is, what is the United States going to do about it? We're in the fearsome choice that Bruce and Larry talk about in their book about the toxic choice of what do you do? You're darned if you do and you're darned if you don't under these circumstances. But it's going to happen. And we can, at best, only delay it happening. I do not think we can prevent it happening. I think that we are going to have a major change in the relationships within the United States of a material nature and the relations between the United States and the rest of the world. And here is where the Christian is going to be called upon to take some hard looks and to make some very difficult decisions. And the question is indeed, as has been written very eloquently, where do we come down under those circumstances? Where is the Christian church, consisting of ourselves, going to be? Because I end with this. In the Oregon state capitol, some of you have been in. You know, there you go in, and there's one building, which is a rather simple marble structure that has the state treasurer's office and the secretary of state and the House of Representatives and the Senate and the governor, all in this one building. There are pictures of Oregon around the scene and it's around the walls, and there's statements. And the one that you see as you walk straight in the front door of the building, right below the governor's balcony, says, "In the souls of its citizens will be found the likeness of the state, which if they be unjust and tyrannical, so will it reflect their vices. But if they be lovers of liberty, confident in their freedoms, so will it be bold in justice, clean in liberty. In the souls of its citizens will be found the likeness of the state." And that's the only hope that I see. I said I was a pessimist when I let off. I said I would be a pessimist if it weren't for my trust in God and the knowledge that He really is in control, but He expects something from His church, from His people, puts the burden back on us. We may be crying in a wilderness. We're not going to find that we are the majority. I think there is great danger that some people who are earnest in their faith sort of take the American flag and the Bible and the Constitution and they wrap it all together as if everything was coterminous. And I don't think it's coterminous. I think that the cry of the Bible is broader even than the cry of the Constitution. And I think the burden is on us. The opportunity is ours.